Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, our celebration of Hispanic American Heritage Month continues with Juan Martinez, author of the short story collection Best Worst American. This program is hosted by the Chicago Council of the American Writers Museum, a group of dedicated professionals who plan and host fundraising events for the museum. It originally took place June 10th, 2020, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Folks, my name is Gary Cranston. If you don't know me, I'm the president here at the American Writers Museum. We're here tonight partly because our Chicago Council, which is an organization of professionals of all kinds who support this museum, promote the museum, and really help us spread the word about the American Writers Museum. So I'm going to ask Katie and Olivia and Heather to come back.
Hey, thank you, Carrie. Everyone, I want to just welcome you all. It's I don't see faces, but I know you're out there. So thank you so much for joining us. The three of us are members of the Chicago Council, and the Chicago Council is part of the American Writers Museum. And really, we are a group of corporate professionals and civic leaders, and we're engaged and invested in the mission and programs of the American Writers Museum. So we have made it a mission of ours to bring writers to people in Chicago and across the country and really expose what's so fun about any kind of books that people are reading, and really being able to give a platform for people to speak about them, look into, investigate, and really enjoy local writers. So thank you, Carrie.
I'm just holding up the book so everybody can see the copy of The Best Worst American by Juan Martinez. As I mentioned, Juan is a professor at Northwestern and a main voice in our special exhibit, and we're really thrilled that he can be here tonight. Juan, do you want to introduce yourself and say hello?
Absolutely. I just want to thank everybody for being here. It is so cool to be able to just talk with people. It's so good to see everybody's faces. I'm kind of bummed that I can't see the attendees, the participants, but I just want to say that I'm waving at everybody and saying hi. It's just very exciting to be here. I just wanted to go ahead and say two very, very quick things, particularly because today is the funeral of George Floyd. And as a Colombian, there is, I think, both systematic oppression and systematic racism in Colombia as well of the Afro-Colombian community. It's, I think, a problem that is spread above and beyond the US. And I just wanted to both acknowledge that and speak to that. And also, just because the funeral of George Floyd happened in Houston, and if anybody found themselves enjoying short stories and realizing, oh my God, I can actually read a short story in 10 minutes or 15 minutes, and it's something I can do, and it makes me feel better about the world in one way or another. Brian Washington's Lot, L-O-T, is this amazing short story collection that's getting all kinds of prizes. And it is a love letter to Houston. You know, it's a messy love letter, but it's awesome. And it has these sort of just beautiful, magical stories of, you know, the entire gamut of what it is to be a human being in Houston and in America. I just wanted to throw out a book that I love out there for anything else, but I'm just so happy. Also, because it's weird when you're just talking about your own book, I just wanted to make sure that I threw some love at another book as well. But I'm so happy to be with you all.
Thank you, Juan. Can you kind of start us off by just talking about this collection and this book and what drove you to put these stories together, and you know, how did that come about?
Absolutely. So the story sort of got generated over a period of, I want to say, almost 15 years, which kind of blows my mind because you don't realize how they're starting. I would do these when I was supposed to be working on a novel. And then when I was getting my PhD in literature, I did these so I would be, wouldn't have to work on my dissertation. So there were just ways to procrastinate on, you know, the real work that I was supposed to be doing at the time. And they've been slowly collecting over that period of time. But they were really all about the very strange experience of what it's like to be both in love with the U.S. and also not quite figuring out what your place in the U.S. is.
Con, where do you live now? Are you here in Chicago?
Yes, we live in Chicago. Okay. We're actually partly because my mother-in-law lives in Kentucky. And during the pandemic, we're in Kentucky right now, just so they could actually help out a little bit, you know, bring groceries, see how she's doing. And so we've been sheltering in place in Kentucky now for the last almost like 2 months now.
Okay. And where did you grow up then?
I grew up in Colombia. So I grew up in, I was born in Colombia, and then almost immediately after I was, my dad got a job in Venezuela. This was during the oil boom back in the, you know, late 70s. And so we were in Venezuela for a bunch of years. He worked on this hydroelectrical dam. So it was actually in a workers' camp for about 7 years, which was, I always say workers' camp, but it had two bowling alleys. It was really fancy. And it was this incredible place where there were Americans there, there were Canadians, there's a Japanese company that I think was in charge of the engine, the turbines. So there's a bunch of different, there's all these sort of people who are just in the jungles of Venezuela. And so those were my formative years. So it's like my first 8 years. And then after that, it was a lot of Colombia and a little bit of the US.
So certainly from your short stories, I feel like I could tell you're from Colombia.
Yes.
But I also thought you were going to be a short, fat, bearded, socially awkward man who loved cats.
Yes.
Any of that true? Like, how do you relate to this voice that I feel like is prevalent in a lot of your short stories?
Well, all of that is true. I mean, we have a cat. We used to have two. So I do love cats. And I was as a fairly fairly fat person. I was as heavy, for a long time. And so all those are little bits of me. I mean, they would have been little bits of me anyway. I don't know. Zadie Smith has a really great line on how basically every character that you put in your fiction is a little bit of you. And so you kind of grow to love all of them. The Machulin, who's the fat bearded cape. He's got. I never wore a cape. I should probably. So for people who
like capes.
I mean, hey, if you can pull it off, you know, that's, you know, and I think Machulin definitely could pull it off. You know, he's got like that. Orson Welles, you know, is notorious for wearing capes, and the Canadian author Robertson Davis, who I adore, is also wore capes. So there's like the part of me like wishes I could wear a cape. So that's the other, I think that there's also like for people who are into fiction or any kind of art, I think you know this already, but there is kind of a Barbie Dreamhouse aspect to fiction where you get to do things in stories that maybe you wouldn't have the boldness or lack of judgment to engage in otherwise. So that's part of the fun of fiction. Yeah.
So Juan, which of the stories, because I think all of them had to kind of, they all touched on really difficult subjects and made us all uncomfortable. I think there was a lot of aspects of your stories that made us uncomfortable, which I think was your point.
Yes.
And it kind of took you out and you didn't really know what to do with it, I think, much of what you talked about being the fact of people trying to fit in and not really quite sure where they fit in. What was your most difficult story to write?
Of these stories? Oh, that's a really good question. I'm going to answer it with, in a slightly bent way. I'm going to tell you like what I feel is the most disturbing story in it, which involves, and I guess like for people who read it, it's a story where at the end there's just a bunch of it's a very disturbing imagery with a bunch of like little demon babies that have sort of been tucked away in a bunch of subdivisions in Las Vegas, you know, by this really monstrous narrator. And it's such an uncomfortable story. That was the easiest story to write. I had like a really fun time writing it.
Why? Tell us why that was so easy.
Well, I think that there's a part of me that loves literary fiction. There's a part of me that loves all kinds of like, you know, I like many other people, I'm a huge fan of writers like Chekhov and Catherine Ann Porter. You know, these writers who do these incredibly beautifully, tonally balanced, beautifully shaped pieces that just, but I also love trashy horror fiction and also trashy horror movies. And there's a lot of stuff that you can say in those genres that I think is just fun. But also like it gives you license to, I think, step over the boundaries of good taste. I think this line is often attributed to Picasso, that good taste is the enemy of great art. So it's, I think genre, when you play with genre, right, especially for me with horror, it's an opportunity to sidestep some of the considerations that I think very carefully crafted fiction asks you to do. So that's a, I don't know. I imagine that some of the people in this, maybe, I know you're all professionals and have awesome jobs, but I don't know if any of you are interested in writing. But one of the things that I always sort of tell people who are into writing, I mean, if you love to read, you may be into writing. And what I always tell them is that if you do, it's always a good idea to connect with the stuff that you loved when you were like 12 or 14, because the stuff that you respond to when you were that young, it might be stuff that you want to return to as a writer. Yeah.
We do have some authors on here right now. I don't know awesome. If they're going to pipe up later in the Q&A or the chat, but yeah, we do. We really do. And we have the founder of the museum, Malcolm O'Hagan, who's on this call right now, all the way from Washington, D.C., which is, you know, one blessing, I guess, out of this whole mess that we're in, not being able to be in person, we are able to bring in people from all over tonight. And that's hi, sister cool. in Maryland. She should be on as well.
Hi, everybody. Yeah, so that, I just realized that was such a long answer and such like the wrong answer to a really good question.
Well, I don't think it's the wrong answer. I think it's part of the process because yeah. I think the process, and so I guess that kind of comes into a question that we had thought about was how do you go about finding your characters and identifying them? It sounds like you identified people who are obviously not able to kind of fit in. I saw there was a lot of Vegas, you know, there's a lot of, are you identifying people, are you identifying communities where you've seen more of the disfranchised individuals living? Are you how are you going about it, and are you doing research with this, and is it based upon kind of a mixture of personal experience, research, that sort of thing?
I mean, a lot of it is personal experience, and a lot of it is so I lived in Vegas for a long time. I was there getting my PhD, so I lived there for 6 years, and because I was an international student. And somebody who wasn't really, and who had always been sort of, had arrived in the U.S. without really, with a student visa. So it wasn't like I was, I couldn't really work outside of the university. I could never really afford a car for a long time. And so one of the most formative and important experiences in my life is in, like, for the many, many years that I was in school in the U.S., is that I always took the bus. Which I know, I just realized we're talking to Chicago, right? So Chicago, we take the L, we take the Metro, we take, well, we don't right now, right? But so a lot of my experience came from this sort of very intense divide that happens between people in car-oriented metropolitan areas like Las Vegas and like Orlando, where if you have a car, you're one type of citizen, and if you don't have a car, and you have to take the bus or walk, then you're very, you know, your experience of the city is very different. So that's when one place where I found the people that I wrote about. But the other part of it is a lot of them, a lot of the people in there are, they're not me, but they're people who share a significant slice of experience that I've sort of lent them.
Definitely snippets of you, because I definitely got the bus part and the cat and the Las Vegas, so all of that. Did you take your cat on the bus?
No, I never did.
Okay.
I never did. But I will say that in that story, I think I actually named the cat, and the cat is named Hodge. And there's a, that is the name of, was the name of the cat that we had at the time. So he's a real cat. He's very sweet. And we never did the leash on him.
I was about to say, was he on a leash?
It would have been a disaster. But again, like Barbie Dreamhouse, right? I can totally take my cat on there.
One of the things that I always find interesting about stories, and I'm sure other people can relate, is that you have to kind of, when you look at stories, it takes you a while to get into them. You can't quite figure out where it's going.
Yeah.
When you're going through the writing process, do you have an end in mind, and then you build back and try to kind of fill in as your, because I think many of us, when we read stories, we're like, wait, the pieces aren't connected yet. And we're just trying to figure out, at some point it comes together. And I'm always curious, in the mind of a writer, are you starting at the end and then you're kind of going in to get there? Because, you know, often as a writer, or as a reader, you're really trying to figure out, do I have to reread this because I've missed some key points at the beginning? And it's just, I'm always curious to know what a writer is thinking about. Are they planning at the end, or are they doing it I'm imagining it's probably different for every writer, but I guess for you specifically, what would that process be like?
That's a good question. I would say that it's not just from writer to writer, but it's from story to story. I think some stories, you know what the end that you're aiming for is, and that's a blessing and a curse, because if you are overdetermining it, you sort of start struggling a little bit with what it is that you're doing. For a lot of the stories, and I know I'm not the only one for whom this happens, you're not really starting with an ending or a situation. Sometimes you're just starting with an image, right? And you're building, and usually it's an image that you can't get rid of, for whatever reason, like an image that just doesn't make sense. And you sort of work your way from that image to a situation and to people and to scenes. And the way that I talk to my students about this in class, and it's something that I stole from the writer Jeff Vandermeer, who, if people know, is from, he did the Area X novels. It was turned into like a Natalie Portman movie with Annihilation. He has a really great insight into this, which is that the order in which the writer discovers the information about a story is not the order in which the reader needs to find it out, right? So there's a lot of work that happens between that first draft of a story, where the writer is figuring stuff out, and the final draft of a story where you're rearranging the information so that it makes some sort of emotional or logical sense for the reader, right? To be taken from a particular beginning to a particular end.
Heather and I talked about this. We were texting late at night when we were reading the book. Some of them seem like streams of consciousness. Is that true? Or, okay. We didn't know if that was just our late.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is sort of like riffing on images, right? And then the images sort of start piling up on each other, right? And they get to a place, right? And a lot of them are, you know, it's usually a fairly lonely voice of a narrator trying to connect with the world and trying to figure out a way to connect with the world.
So was that just for Best Worst American, or is all of your writing like that? Do you have different styles? Do you do a longer novels as well? I know you mentioned horror genre, but I didn't know if those were also short or long.
No, so I'm a lot of it is some of it is similar. Some of the techniques go from one project to the next, and some of them are not. Like the two, I'm working on two novels right now, and in both of them, I would say the presentation is a little bit more straightforward. Part of it is, you know, like when you're asking somebody to invest in 300 or 600 pages of time with some people, I don't want a lot of I don't want a lot of the stuff that it's a big time commitment, and you don't want people to get lost, right? I don't mind somebody getting a little lost and a little bit like navigating through the thicket of like somebody's consciousness, because you know you'll be out of it, or you know you know when you read a short story, you know, oh, I'm going to be out of here in like a page or five pages. So it can be very dense, but it can be very very short.
Yeah, I found that. I thought it was an interesting comment that you made at the beginning, because especially I feel like people's attention spans are, you know, especially, I mean, you know, Olivia, Heather, and I had enough hard enough time organizing this whole thing in terms of getting together that, it's, you know, especially being busy professionals, I have a hard time sitting down with a book.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have told people every year my New Year's resolution, I never do it. My New Year's resolution is to read a book a month. And then I start out with that New Year's resolution and I never get it done. And I find short stories so much easier to internalize. And I don't know if that's a matter of my attention span. I have young kids. I think the end of the day is I don't have a lot of time for myself. What I really enjoyed was it doesn't feel as daunting, because you can really, like you said, kind of absorb these kind of, and you don't feel like you have to go at it for a long, long time to try and get into, which can be mentally exhausting, especially when you go there. So do you prefer the short story genre? Do you prefer that way? Or do you think, does it feel somewhat limited because you can't expand over pages and pages about certain characters? Because I imagine your characters seem very complex. They're, you know, in reading some of them, you're just like, where do these people come from? And so, you know, I imagine it can be both overwhelming, but also gratifying to have a very extensive investigation to people. So would you take any of these short stories at any point and kind of make a bigger novel out of it? Is that something that you ever thought about? Because, or are you considering the reader too? Because these are very intense type of individuals that you're reading about. And I think I just talked about the fact that a lot of our attention spans are limited in terms of the ability to process.
So, yeah, I think for me, what I've learned probably the hard way is that, as much as I love characters, and as much as I love to follow a character around, and again, this is not every writer. This is just, it just depends on the writer. I actually need a much clearer set of stakes when it comes to a novel, and a much more defined plot arc. Like like, it's just one of those things where I just gotta be honest with myself. And like, when I read a novel, I want characters to follow and I want to believe in them, but I also want to know what's going to happen next a lot of times. And so I know that there's writers who are capable of perfectly balancing, you know, these sort of complex characters and fun kind of plots that unfold. For my part, I kind of have to dial back, you know, character density, and sort of just go for funny or fun kind of stuff happening on the page. So that's the thing. And I'm also like working on shorts. I mean, but I love both forms. I'm working on a series of short stories that are all set in Chicago right now.
And that's great.
Yeah. And they're fantastic. Actually, one just came out in Shenandoah, just this amazing web journal. out of Washington and Lee University, and it's about Andersonville. And it's like this really messy love letter to Andersonville.
Juan, I have a question based on some of what you were talking about. As you were talking about the idea of the short story versus the novel, one of the questions that I had was sort of this notion of what, when it comes to assembling a book of short stories, what thought did you put into the notion of order of those stories? You know, what drives that kind of process?
It's a really good question. And sequencing in short stories is, there's a bunch, you'll get a bunch of advice, especially if you've ever been taking a creative writing class or gotten an MFA or anything. There's a couple of like rules of thumb that people do. Like one of which is that you kind of want a grabby, kind of like a loud story first, just to catch people's attention. And what I've heard is you always kind of go for like a very strong story at the beginning, strong story to end, something in the middle that's kind of like wakes people up. So that's sort of the...
Stop, they're all strong. They're all strong.
Thank you, Olivia. That's so kind. Thank you. Just to be 100% real with you all, I don't know of any writer who's actually ever felt that way about their own work, that they're, you know, especially when you're writing short stories, that they're all strong. And I have a bunch of graduate students that I sort of shepherd through, you know, their collections, especially when they're doing short story collections. And they're always sort of freaking out about like this one story that's not good enough. And I always, my two go-to stories actually come from music. And I told them like, listen, like the Beatles, every time they would assemble an album, they always thought of like, we have two singles and those are the good songs. And then we have the filler and that's the rest of the album. So if you think you have one bad story, you know, like John and Paul were like, you know.
Just put it in the middle. Is that
Yeah, they just put it in the middle and it, you know, it's Eleanor Rigby or whatever, right? So yeah. And then like, go ahead.
No. I was going to say, we have a couple questions. Do you mind if I...
Oh, my God, no. I would love to answer questions.
Yeah, I just figured I want to make sure people feel that their questions are being answered.
Yes.
So I'm sorry if I sound like a robot, but I'm going to read them. One question is, I'm particularly taken with the stories in this collection that are vignettes, and I'm especially intrigued by Strangers on Vacation, snapshots. I don't think I've ever felt too compelled to do a close reading of a short story before. All of which is to say, could you talk about the inspiration for that story and what you see as the symbolism of the weevil?
Cool. Okay. First of all, hi, Clayton. I see that's the question. And that's a really fantastic question. So I think that what I can say is that sometimes these, especially the very, very short stories, are begin to be sort of like examinations of like a very small thing that you find and that you never know exactly how to feel about it. And in that one was like, what happens when you see somebody like you completely don't know and it's their vacation photos and you start flipping, you know, like for whatever reason, like you're visiting a house and there's like a stack of photos and you kind of go, oh, they were in Bermuda. That's nice. Right. Or like, oh, and now they're in, like, okay, they're in Pittsburgh. Okay, right? And so there's this that's sort of like the very weird feeling that people get when you start building a story out of other people's memories. So that's definitely where a part of that story came out. And I think the idea of the weevil is anytime anybody says symbolism and says, could you explain why this is here? I think writers want to get very kind of flippant about it and say, oh, I don't know. I just thought a weevil was funny, right? I can tell you right now that I knew when I was playing with this story, I think I had a couple of other animals. And of course, Disney World, there's like all sort of things. There's the fact that it's kind of funny to be, you start thinking, what are some inappropriate theme park you know, costumes that we could throw in there. But because the weevil can be like an invasive species in the story, and, you know, he starts showing up in other things, it felt like a nice sort of way of reinforcing the idea that there was something invasive about characters showing up again and again in different places, but also maybe a little bit in the invasiveness of a narrator grafting a story onto somebody else. So if you're a writer, Clayton, I don't know if you are or not, that's a trick that I think works really well for people is when you have an idea or an image or anything, if you just keep putting it in over and over and over again, it starts making its own meaning just by the way it rubs up against other things. I hope that was helpful.
So our next question is from a good friend of mine who's also an author. She published her first book recently, Angela Terry, out in San Francisco. She asked, were there any authors that inspired you to become a writer? And if so, what was it about their writing or story that inspired you?
Angela, that's a really cool question. And I want to keep it super short because I also want to ask you, like, I want to hear about your book. So please tell me about it as well. But as for that question, there's many writers. As a Colombian, you can't really get under the shadow of Gabriel Garcia Marquez. So he was a big one. Love Garcia Marquez. For me, Vladimir Nabokov, the Russian-American writer who wrote Lolita and Penin and Pale Fire and a bunch of other amazing short stories as well. He was a huge inspiration. I just loved how he wrote. I loved how he could wind his way around the sentence in some really ways. I like the boldness of the way he could just make a story just fracture your mind in some ways. But also the fact that he was a non-native English speaker who had sort of involved himself deeply with what you could do with the English language and, you know, how could you take it. Yeah. So that was the person.
You know how your spouse interviews you when you're dating? My husband made me read Love in the Time of Cholera when we were dating. And if I didn't like it, I don't think he would have married me.
Oh, man.
That's hey, Heather. Heather, do you have any guests on the Q&A who have asked some questions?
We just said Clayton, who, by the way, said that he could talk to you for 2 hours about that story.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so Angela asks, how old were you when you first started writing, and did you know you always wanted to write?
I started young, but I never, and when I say young, I guess I love to read. I was a voracious reader. I read, like, from... I have memories of reading when I was 6 or 7. But I didn't really know that I wanted to be a writer. I loved comic books and I loved movies. And I really thought that I was going to be a movie director. I think I wanted to be, I really wanted to be a movie director for a long time. So I didn't quite figure out that writing was the thing that I wanted to do, or that even that I felt that I was good at it, until I took a creative writing class when I was a college student in Orlando. And I had my professor, Susan Hubbard, said to me, hey, you know, you're really good at this. And that's the first time anybody had said that to me. So that felt really good. Yeah.
Awesome.
So that's when I kind of knew. But I admire people who are like, oh, I knew. I was like, you know, I wrote my first novel. It was 5 pages. It was about mummies. That wasn't me.
that's why people like you. You're honest.
Yeah.
I can ask the next one. Cheryl Ziegler.
Hi, Cheryl.
Apologies for straying from the book, but you are a wonderful artist. Love your Post-it drawings. Any plans for combining your drawings with your short stories?
It'll happen, I think, eventually. I'm finishing up. When I say finishing, I'm halfway through a book of short stories on Chicago that I'm hoping to finish by the middle of next year, you know, knock on wood. I really want to do something that mixes art, like mixes drawings and narrative. I still don't know how I'm going to do it. I'm still kind of figuring out what you know, what are some things that can work with that in some ways? But it's definitely, the post-it drawings are definitely kind of training. And for, I guess I just realized people who do, on Twitter and on Instagram, I will doodle some stuff and will post a very, kind of like this very, a post-it, you know, it's always drawn on a post-it. And then it has a very long kind of ridiculous description of what it is. For a long time, it was always like the Willis Tower with googly eyes, doing stuff that you wouldn't think that the Willis Tower would do, like you know, go night swimming in Lake Michigan.
Okay, so the next question is either submitted by Esther Chang, which is what it shows, or Laura Schwartz, who just texted me the exact same question. So both lovely, lovely ladies here in Chicago. Esther is an attorney at Mayor Brown, and Laura is an author and a great friend of ours and a huge supporter of the museum. She's emceed several events for the Chicago Council. We, you know, our first event was this crazy costume party, the Great Gatsby theme party. It was so much fun. And then we did a vampire theme last October. So thank you to all the Chicago Council supporters out there. So the question is my reflection. Thank you for sharing your approach regarding your first draft versus a draft the reader sees. I feel like that relates to life now as we know it among George Floyd and what draft we are in. How Black Lives, wait, sorry, what draft we are on in how Black Lives Matter and in this unfortunate journey of COVID. My question, do you have a space, either physically or emotionally, that you go to write? Thank you.
Yeah, that is such a good question. And I like how we're tying it to this idea of what where we're at right now in history, right? Because we're in a really terrible, messy draft, right? We don't know what's gonna happen. And you know, we hope, I think that things are gonna be better and good. So I think that there's a very real sense that what we do in our writing can mirror the processes that we experience in life, right? And the idea that we can try at least to be aim for improvement, try to do better. So yeah, it's absolutely. That I just want to make sure, I just wanted to acknowledge the truth of what you just said. I think that's it's a very real thing, right? That all drafts exist in potentiality, right? In the idea. And just to keep that analogy going, one thing that I always tell my students, and I always sort of have learned the hard way, is that, you know, there is no such thing as writer's block. There's only the fact that, oh man, just, I don't know if you can hear, my five-year-old is crying right
now. Thank you.
It's okay, we're all in the same boat.
Yeah.
He can come say hi.
Yeah. But I think, okay, good. He's okay. Yeah. But the other side of that, I think, is that right, like when you're writing a story, I think people begin with a lot of great intentions, a lot of good intentions. People who've written, you know this. People just starting out writing, you know this. And it's really easy to begin a story or begin a project or begin any endeavor. It's really hard to finish it. And one of the things that you need is sort of to trust the process and realize that if you keep working on it, it'll eventually get finished and you'll eventually make it better. And so that's what I would say is my emotional state when I write, the emotional space that I write in is this space of trust in the fact that whatever I'm doing for the present day, if I'm with it, it will eventually be better, and it will eventually get done. Like, you know, I just need to, you know, even, and it's hard right now, of course. I think we're in a moment where a lot of our attention necessarily has to be toward what's going on in the streets and what's going on politically, and that is absolutely cool. But as writers, one of our jobs is just to take notes, right? Just to keep going. And just to finish this very, very quickly, physically, the space that works best for me in writing has less to do with a room and more with the fact that I'm writing everything by hand these days. I do everything every first draft is I do by hand. It just makes my writing better because I'm a good artist because I can't go on Twitter or, you know, look at the Washington Post news alert and see what fresh ore has landed.
Kind of in line with that, Peg Duncan wants to know, how much time do you spend each day on your writing?
These last couple of weeks have been really hard, so I have not been writing. The part of it is the fact that I am preparing a course, and because of COVID, the course is online, and so a lot of energy and effort has to go to making sure that the course is solid online, but that takes a lot of, you know, forward work. Yeah. Normally, though, and this varies for a lot of people, but if I can put in half hour to an hour a day, I'm happy. And it usually leads to enough material. Yeah.
Heather, do you want to hit up David's question?
Yeah, I've got, and this is actually my friend Josh Carter, who used to be at the Goodman Theater in Chicago.
Oh, cool.
Down in Atlanta. Josh wants to know, has writing stories that touch on identity or belonging influenced your own sense of belonging?
That's a really good question. They actually, yeah. So like one of the ways in which I wish I could remember who said this first, but one of the things that I love about literature is that I used to think I'm this weirdo who keeps having these imaginary conversations with people, real people, in my head at all times, right? Like, I'm talking to you all right now, I'm saying stuff, and then I'm sure in like 10 minutes when I say goodbye to you all and I go to other things, later tonight I'm gonna say, oh my God, why didn't I say this perfectly, beautifully tuned thing to Heather? I should have said this to Heather. And then tomorrow, Heather, I may wake up thinking of the thing, still having this conversation with you, right, in my head. And somebody said that, like, the beauty of literature, right, is that you get to see everybody's imaginary conversations broken open, and you realize, oh, I'm not this one weirdo who has this imaginary conversations. Everybody's a weirdo. Everybody has these conversations. Everybody's trying to connect, right? Everybody's trying to make sense of the world, and sort of being able to inhabit somebody else's consciousness and seeing how that happens helps you sort of negotiate your way around the world. So that's the reading part of it, but definitely writing has helped me figure out stuff about myself, not to get too therapeutic about it, but it's definitely has helped me understand the ways in which I feel I belong and the ways in which I know I don't.
Well, it looks like your neighbors have chimed in.
Oh my God, Lisa, Charles.
Lisa, Chuck, and Daphne.
Yes, I know them all. All of them are cats.
They have a question for you. Their question is, how do you know when a short story is complete? The collection of short stories. Yeah, how do you know when you've done enough, essentially?
That's a really good question. For people who are putting collections together, it's always it's difficult to navigate it because on the one hand, you want to put everything you've done, right? Like, these are all the stories I've done. On the other hand, you want to see how the stories are talking to each other. And so the way in which I navigated, I can definitely say, like, the way in which Best Worst American, I knew when Best Worst American was done was when I had this weird 1-2 punch of, like, a story that veered from the very comic into, like, the very horrific. And then a story that was very, very short, that was commissioned for NPR. That's the title story. That was just about reconciliation, about sort of people coming together despite pain. And so that's sort of, I realized, oh, I have the two extremes of the thing that I was exploring. You know, sort of navigating this idea of, like, how many different angles can you have on this one idea? And then I found them. With the new collection, I kind of cheated, I want to say, and because it's about Chicago, but every story has an app. Every story is about an app. So, like, you know, Twitter, obviously, but, like, I realized that for a long time, I was sort of obsessed with Redfin and Zillow. and just would just continuously scroll. And actually the story that just came out on Shenandoah, that story is sort of the app for that story is Redfin and Zillow. So for that one, I just have like, these are the apps that I'm hitting on. And then when I'm done with them, I'm done with them. And so I'm like, I think I'm three apps away from all the stories.
I don't know how you choose the apps. There's so many.
Oh, it's just the apps that I, it's the apps that I'm, and again, for anybody who's writing, right? It's the apps that I, like, I literally don't know what to do with. And not like I know what to do with them, right? But like that I keep getting eBay reminders for like this one alert that I set up like 5 years ago and then forgot to turn off. And now it's like a friend. Like I kind of want to catch up on. So like, what, you know, like when you ask yourself a question, like, why can't I turn off this app, right? Or why is it that I will go and check out Dark Skies or AccuWeather and check that, even though I can clearly see that it's snowing or whatever. I don't need to be on AccuWeather to know that it's snowing, right?
That's a great question.
Yeah. That's how I determine which ones they were there. It's the ones that really mess me up in one way or another.
Let's see. Sometimes the best American short stories can be found in unexpected places, like Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. Do you agree?
Oh my God. Yes, David. Yeah, totally. So I am a huge fan of genre. And Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine is just one of those flagship genre journals. I would add things like the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction by Charles Finley, Asimov's and Analog, which are both extraordinary science fiction journals. Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet. I mean, there's a bunch, there's many, many great journals, but one of the things that I like about the way the literary fiction marketplace has shifted is that we all know how, like, you can't have, like, you really can't do American literature these days without really acknowledging the primacy of what used to be called the trashy genres, and how many amazing writers and amazing stories are there, right? And like, you look at the Library of America these days, and you know, you see like John McDonald obviously people like Ursula Le Guin, just these great writers who would have been published in, you know, magazines where, you know, there's a rocket ship and somebody in a bikini with like a ray gun, right? But
I think those are all the questions that we have. This was wonderful. I mean, I think, yeah, to be able, is there anything that you feel like that was not asked of you that you would like to share? Oh, looks like there was one more question. Let's see. Oh, if I can ask this, did you see this question? Does your Colombian heritage influence your writing?
I can answer that heavily.
Go ahead, go for it.
heavily,
yes.
Absolutely.
That's a great question, right? For people who read Marquez, he has a great line on that, right? It's like, how did you come up with magical realism? And I'm going to paraphrase it, but he basically says, you know, like, that's magical realism is in Colombia, that's just realism, right? Just really weird stuff happens and you just sort of have to roll with it. So yeah, my, you know, being Colombian is part and parcel of my writing. It's just, you know, I can't get away from it. I will never want to get away from it. I love Colombia and I'm just really happy that I get to share some bits and pieces of it with people who are non-Colombian, and then also I know that for people who maybe are familiar with it, or if they're not familiar, or if they're familiar with it but not Colombian, or they've been there, or they've, you know, they're in an adjacent country, a lot of the cultural stock and knowledge that shows up in the stories in different ways, it's just nice to have those little bits of like common currency that I think is, you know, it's always nice when somebody recognizes them. Yeah.
I was just going to say, I think we've kind of come up on an hour, and
oh wow,
I know it went rather quickly.
Yeah.
So this has been a really great conversation, and I wanted to thank Juan, and I wanted to thank the Chicago Council. Thank you again, Juan. And thank you, Olivia and Katie and Heather and everybody who attended tonight. This was really enjoyable, and I'm glad we got a chance to do it. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, Juan.
All right, everybody. Take care.
Thank you, Carrie. Night.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, we'll catch up with playwright and screenwriter Sarah Gubbins, who will discuss her recent film, Shirley, starring Elizabeth Moss as Shirley Jackson. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.